Ezekiel 44. And I'm going to go ahead and read the first three verses again so we can remember. Mm-hmm. So, chapter 44, verse 1. Then he brought me back to the outer gate of the sanctuary, outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces toward the east, but it was shut. And the Lord said to me, this gate shall be shut. It shall not be opened, and no man shall enter by it, because the Lord God of Israel has entered by it, therefore it shall be shut. As for the prince, because he is the prince, he may sit in it to eat bread before the Lord. He shall enter by way of the vestibule of the gateway, and go out the same way. So this is the gate on the east side where God's visible glory, manifest presence, the Shekinah as it's called, had come in, and then it was shut. And it was shut for a couple reasons. One is because he had gone through it, and therefore it's kind of considered holy entrance. Other people aren't supposed to go there. And then the second thing was, by having it shut, he's demonstrating that he's not going to leave. That he's going to stay there forever. As far as, again, as we talked about the word Olam, meaning a long extended period. So the implication is that the sin of the people is not going to force him to leave, like happened earlier in Ezekiel. Remember earlier, mm-hmm. In Ezekiel's day, before the temple was destroyed by Babylon, he sees the glory of the Lord move and eventually leave and go up to the Mount of Olives. So this is kind of the bookend to that, where the glory of the Lord comes back to this temple, and he's not going to leave again. And then there's this mention of this person, the prince. And so we looked at some of the different passages that mention the prince in Ezekiel's book to try to figure out who he might be. And the idea of the prince is mentioned earlier in Ezekiel 34 and in Ezekiel 37. Like if we go to Ezekiel 34:24, God is talking to Ezekiel about a period of time where he's going to establish, kind of restore things. And so in Ezekiel 34:23, it says, I will establish one shepherd over them, that is over Israel. He shall feed them, my servant David, he shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. So there, there are many people who think that passage is talking about David specifically, as opposed to a son of David. And there's many other people who think that that's talking about Jesus, because of the emphasis on a shepherd. He will be their shepherd. And so there's a sense in which the phrase my servant David could mean specifically King David resurrected, right? Or it could also mean a person in the line of David, out of David's loins. So that's one passage which seems to imply that the prince would be potentially David or the Messiah. And then in Ezekiel 37, if you go a couple chapters over, and it's talking there in verse 24, we'll see the same kind of idea. Maybe someone could read 24 and 25.
I will. David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd. And they shall also walk in my judgments, and observe my statutes, and do them. Then they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob my servant, where your fathers dwelt, and they shall dwell there, they, their children, and their children's children forever, and my servant David shall be their prince forever.
So there again, you see. So if you just take those two passages, you know, strictly at their face value, they imply David, resurrected King David. But we saw some other passages that I think preclude it being David, as far as David could be a prince, but the prince that's mentioned in the passage that we are seeing in Ezekiel 44 and beyond has some aspects that don't fit real well with either the Messiah or David, and we looked at those last time briefly. One was in Ezekiel 45. If we go to Ezekiel 45:12, did I say that? Is that right? That's not the right place. Oh, gee. What did I do? Oh, maybe it's... Let's see. I guess 46:12 is closer to what I had in mind. But I don't think that's the actual one I'm looking for. But it does say there that he prepares, the prince makes a voluntary burnt offering or peace offering to the Lord. And it says, he shall prepare his burnt offering, his peace offering. So whoever this prince is making offerings, which doesn't seem like something that a glorified person would be doing. And especially there's another, if we go to verse 18, in that same chapter, there's a warning to the prince. The prince shall not take any of the people's inheritance by evicting them from their property. So whoever the prince is can potentially do something wrong, right? So that's certainly not Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he has sons.
And then he has, and it talks about, implies physical offspring, his sons. So that, I think that precludes the resurrected David, because he's glorified. Mm-hmm. He would be sinless. Mm-hmm. Messiah is certainly sinless.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another passage, and I guess I don't have the right, I thought it was Ezekiel 45:12, but I've got a typo in that somewhere, but there's one passage where he makes an offering for himself. And so that again is a really strong indication that he can sin. He's sinful. Mm-hmm. He's still affected by the sin of Adam. So again, he wouldn't be the Messiah, and he wouldn't be...
Well, there's a whole section there that are laws governing the prince in 45, starting at 9.
Okay, yeah. You want to read that for us?
Yeah. You want all of that?
Well, just, you know.
Well, because at 12 it talks about offering it.
Okay. So maybe I just went to the wrong place when I was looking, and that was the right address, but I was in the wrong place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
In 13 it talks about offering that he should offer. Can we read some of this?
Yeah, sure.
From where to where? 9 through 13?
Yeah, that's talking about princes, though, in general, right?
Oh, my subtopic is laws governing the prince.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Oh, there's ones above that, too. Properties of the city and the prince.
Yeah, okay. Verse 9 says, enough, O princes of Israel.
Okay.
But it does get into the... It does... say, where is it?
In 13, this is the offering which you shall offer.
Right. But he's saying, I think the you there is talking to the princes or the leaders.
Okay.
because he says, you know, remove violence and plundering, execute justice to start with.
Okay,
and then in 16, I guess, it's all the people of the land shall give this offering for the prince in Israel. This is shall be the prince's part to give burnt offerings, grain offerings, drink.
Okay.
And then there it is. He shall prepare the sin offering. Where is it? That's for making atonement for the house of Israel.
yes.
Anyway, there's in 16 it does talk about an offering for the prince of Israel, but I think that that's talking about that he's involved with it.
Okay.
Anyway, and that's not the exact place I was looking for, but it's close. But anyway, I think when you look at these different issues, the prince is in the line of David, probably not David, probably not Jesus, but a descendant, still a physical descendant of David, who, you know, that sounds like a really strange idea, because, again, we're kind of trained with the idea that the last descendant of David that has any relevance to anything is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is a descendant of David that is sinful,
mm-hmm.
and this is a future time, it can't be David, and it can't be... Hello, come on in.
Hi.
Joseph.
I seem to misplace it.
Oh.
And so I turned it back up.
Oh.
And I'm thinking while I was laying on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be on the couch.
Could it have gone down between the cushions?
Very possible. It fell down in those cushions.
I remember taking my phone out of my pocket and showing
yeah, you're
my daughter to a couple people.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay, so
and I got a thing, and I searched the house everywhere.
Yeah. Well,
don't get up.
Yeah, as soon as we get home, we'll look
home
for it.
Give me a
yeah,
call.
We'll do that.
Do you have my number?
I'm not sure.
It's in my wallet.
Oh, I have your card.
I've got your wallet. I was going to say, I have your card in the wallet.
Yeah.
Your wallet.
Well,
yeah,
no, I have it.
Oh, you have it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll call you either way as soon as we get home.
I hung it on your refrigerator.
Yeah,
it had fallen on the...
I apologize for disturbing.
Oh,
no, that's fine.
No problem.
Got to your house and Monday night. That's
Yeah, it very well could be right there. Hopefully the dog didn't eat it, but...
Oh, well, that would be...
No,
traces I could replace it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
That's
we'll
yours. You like
yeah.
the
problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. See you later.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a number of solid commentators who, not just me, I'm just telling you, I'm not the only weird one that has this weird view, but there's a number of pretty careful commentators that conclude that it's probably a future descendant of David, which is a strange idea because, as we talked about briefly last time, it implies that the line of David is still relevant.
In fact.
Still relevant.
But isn't that a promise that there will always be someone on that throne?
Well, yeah, but see, so most people would say that, and I would agree with this view, that the one who fulfills the promise of always being available to be on the throne would be Jesus.
Right.
And since he's eternal,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's not really an issue. So you don't really, you think of the whole line of David pretty much ending in significance at Jesus,
mm-hmm.
right? And so since King David was a predecessor of Jesus, then, you know, he doesn't have as much relevance, although
mm-hmm.
here, obviously, he's either he or a descendant is, you know, definitely David's going to be resurrected,
mm-hmm.
just like all the saints, right? And so then those earlier passages in Ezekiel are either talking about David himself, Jesus as his descendant, or talking about this person that
mm-hmm.
potentially is a descendant of David. Those passages don't really mention anything that specifies whether the person is sinful or not. They just say he's a shepherd, a good
mm-hmm.
shepherd, etc. But when we get to the end here and it talks about the prince, it doesn't specifically say David in these sections, but it does say things about that don't match a glorified individual or the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you put that all together, then it seems like if you take the earlier statements that he's related to David and these later statements that he's a sinner, that he's got to be a descendant of David
mm-hmm.
at that time, just in the same way that the Levites, right, have a descendant. So it all gets back to that passage in Jeremiah where it's talking about, I think we're going to have to go there, if I can remember where it is, Jeremiah 33, I think it is. So in Jeremiah 33, in verse 14, there's this really strong passage having to do with the Davidic throne, the throne of David. And the thing about it is that when we normally read this passage, we're always focused on the throne of David, but intermingled with it is a promise to the Levitical priestly line. So if somebody could read like 14 through 18 for us, we can look at that again.
That'd be good.
Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the good word which I have spoken concerning the house of Israel and the house of Judah. In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on the earth. In those days, Judah shall be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell in safety, and this is the name by which she shall be called, the Lord is our righteousness. For thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel, and the Levitical priest shall never lack a man before me to offer burnt offerings, to burn grain offerings, and to prepare sacrifices continually.
Maybe you could go on and read through 22.
The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, saying, thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant for the day and my covenant for the night, so the day and the night will not be at their appointed time, then my covenant may also be broken with David my servant, that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne, and with the Levitical priests, my ministers. And the hosts of heaven cannot be counted, and the sand of the sea cannot be measured, so I will multiply the descendants of David my servant and the Levites who minister to me.
So, you know, this whole section is very strong. Whenever God, you know, when he's essentially swearing by, you know, this, the day and the night, more or less, you can break my covenant with the day and the night. So he's like underscoring this, and he's saying these strong things about David, but then immediately after it, he connects this Levitical line. And so where most Christians will go with this is that, well, Jesus is a king and a priest, so he fulfills both parts. And as we talked about earlier, you can't really do that because Jesus is not in the Levitical line.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And so if you try to make Jesus fulfill this whole passage, you're breaking other things the Bible says. In Hebrews, it goes to great lengths to say that Jesus is not in the Levitical line. He's in the order of Melchizedek. He wasn't born of Levi, right? If he was born of Levi, so Judah and Levi are brothers, you know. So if Jesus is born of Judah, he can't be born of Levi. And if he's born of Levi, he can't be born of Judah. So you got to pick one or the other. He's either in the Levitical line, or he's in the kingly line. But when you talk about priests and kings and you put them in terms of tribal people, you can't have one individual that meets both of those requirements. So you end up with a situation where, you know, you can go, like, I think one of them's like the Nelson Study Bible. If you read what they say on this, they basically tell you that Jesus fulfills both parts.
Oh.
And they're not alone. There's a number of of commentators that say, oh yeah, that's Jesus. We know he's a priest and king, and that's Jesus. And I'm like, well, he's son of David. He's not son of Levi.
Right.
So when we go to the Gospels and they talk about son of David, have mercy on me, I hear him say son of Levi. So...
isn't that a pretty conservative commentary?
Well, it's conservative, yeah. It's just a big boo-boo. So, you know, it's a theological boo-boo. So what's weird about this passage when you read it is it takes you a while, like in my case, years, to realize that Jesus can't fulfill that whole thing. And that the promises that are made in the Levitical line are just as strong as the promises that are made in this David's line, you know, because he says there, if you can break my covenant with day and night, then my covenant can be broken with David and with the Levites. And it turns out that, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at the Davidic covenant, but there's also this priestly covenant, which barely just is hardly ever mentioned, you know, and I'm kind of embarrassed. I did a series of messages on the covenants of the Bible here quite a few years ago, and I never mentioned the priestly covenant because nobody teaches on it. And so once you start looking at it, you go, well, wait a minute. There's this other promise that's going through this priestly line. It doesn't lead to Jesus. And here, if you look at this passage, the duration of the promise to the Davidic line and the duration of the promise to the Levitical line look to be very similar. They're wedded together, right? And so in one, we know it ends ostensibly in Jesus, and the other doesn't. So already we got something really weird to deal with, because we've got one line that ends in the Son of God, and well, he's special, obviously, and that's fine, we're all happy with that, but this other promise, where does it go? Mm-hmm. And then if you go off and start looking at this covenant, you know, that starts with Levi and goes through Aaron and goes through Phinehas and eventually goes to Zadok, you find in Ezekiel, where we are now, mm-hmm. we're going to see in a couple more verses, Zadok pops up again. And so what you conclude is the stuff that's at the end of Ezekiel is tied into this covenant in Jeremiah, that this Levitical promise doesn't go to Jesus, it continues down through a human line and all the way into the millennial kingdom, which means that it's on its way today. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so what did we just see over in Ezekiel when we were looking at the characteristics of this prince? We saw that, well, he looks like he's in the line of David. Looks like he can't be the Son of God. Looks like he can't be the glorified King David. And we've talked before about the odd idea that in the millennial kingdom you have people who are in their normal unglorified state that have survived the tribulation, and you have glorified saints who have been raised for the kingdom, the millennial kingdom, side by side. And the implication is that this offspring of David is one of these people that enters the millennium. And so that means two things. It means not only is there a line of Levi that's still ongoing, that's of significance, the same is true of David. And that's a very strange and uncomfortable idea. There's many Christians who are very uncomfortable with what I'm saying here, because in their mind there can't be anything that's of significance involving David besides Jesus. And here we're saying, well, it looks like there's a human descendant of David in the millennial kingdom who's going to be doing some things. And the Bible doesn't say that's impossible by any means, but we've kind of have this idea that all the promises to David and everything in to David come to not a dead end, but a living end, if you will, at Jesus. I mean, Jesus, boom, that's it. And here we have the idea that no, there still is somehow something related to David. And so when you go back and you look at the descendants of David, of course, they're, you know, it's a fairly wide deal. I mean, even in the Gospels, you see two genealogies that come through David, one through Solomon, one through St. Nathan. I think the other one is two different sons of one. In Matthew, it's through Solomon, and in Luke, it's through Nathan, I think it is. And one leads to Mary. It would appear one leads to Mary, and one leads to Joseph and Jesus. So that's why some commentators and myself say, well, if you really try to fit this all together in Ezekiel, I think you're seeing a similar thing to what the Levitical line is here. The Levitical line goes down to Zadok. This line here in David, in this part we just read, seems like it just terminates at Jesus, and it may well, from the focus of what's said here, just have Jesus in mind. But once you get over to the Ezekiel passage, you've got this problem. What do you do with this prince? Right? And you can't make him Jesus, because he's being told, don't do that. Since when did anyone tell Jesus, don't do anything? Right?
Yeah.
And then there's this whole issue of making sin offerings, atoning. Like, well, that can't be. And we also know that when we're glorified, that's when we're perfected. So if David's raised to be in the millennial kingdom, as all the Old Testament saints will be, he's not going to need to be offering sacrifices and stuff for himself. So I don't know where to go with it other than to observe those things and to point those things out. And, you know, some people too, they're like real uncomfortable with the idea that, you know, they would say to me, they'd say, well, Tony, you know, you're so caught up in this cold logic. You know, the Bible isn't like that.
You know, yes, it is.
Yes, it is. That's right. And, you know, because somehow people like, there's a devotional. So whenever you say things like this, like, well, the line of David has continuing significance besides just Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking away from Jesus. That's how they view it. You're taking away from Jesus' glory. Because Jesus is everything. Everything terminates in Jesus. And you know, and that's why when we talk about continued significance for Israel, they don't like that either, because in their mind, you know, it's all about Jesus, and now you're saying that there's a nation that's important to God, not just the Son of God, right? So there's all these different things that when you just follow the scriptures and you try to make sense of them, you end up bringing up things that make people uncomfortable, partly because they have kind of a view that everything just kind of, there's Jesus and there's nothing more outside of Jesus.
Who do they think the prince is? It's just a story?
Well, yeah, so the majority of people in that category there's quite a few who say that it's David. In fact, the Bible Knowledge Commentary, which is one that I highly regard as a commentary, it's a two-volume commentary out of Dallas Theological Seminary, and the editors are John Walvoord and Roy Zook, who are both dead now but fabulously knowledgeable about the scriptures. The person who's writing the Ezekiel part of it, I'm trying to think which professor did Ezekiel, he thinks it's David.
I think Andy Woods thinks it's David.
Does he?
I was reading listening to an overview of that, and I could have sworn he said, I mean, I haven't listened to it in 6 months or so, but I could have sworn to it that he said that was David.
Yeah. Well,
what would somebody like Cain Kinnegrath say?
Well, he would say there is no millennial temple. This is a picture of the church, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
the prince. The millennial kingdom has no temple.
Well, the millennial temple kingdom has a temple. What do you think about what...
What he would say?
Well, he doesn't believe in the millennium.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because we're in the millennial reign of Christ.
Yeah.
Right.
So, there's all different ways they will take Revelation 20, mm-hmm. which talks about two resurrections. And the most common one is they'll say the first resurrection is when you're born again. Right. Mm-hmm. You come to life in Christ. And the second resurrection, they'll say, is like a physical resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And in between is an indeterminate period of time, which we're in now, more or less, or when people, you know, are born again until that period of the actual physical resurrection.
So they would say this part in Ezekiel where there's sacrifices isn't during that time then.
Right. And they would say, well, yeah, because the book of Hebrews proves there can't be any other sacrifices.
Right.
So that's what they would say. And then they would also say, Some would also say that this is unrealized eschatology, you know, which is kind of a way of saying this is Ezekiel's describing something that could have been but didn't come about because of changes that occurred since then.
And that would kind of cancel his prophecy.
Prophesying
something and then they're saying it didn't come true.
Right. And then there's this issue when you get to Jeremiah 33, what do you do with the promises to the Levitical line, right?
Yeah.
And so then they'll say things like, well, we're priests of God, right? Believers,
mm-hmm.
kingdom of priests,
mm-hmm.
so it's fulfilled in us. And yeah, it said Levi back there, but that just means
we're not
priestly
Jewish.
Line, and we're in the priestly line now. So they're less precise in their requirements. So when I read certain things, I'm reading them in a way where I'm like wanting to cross T's and dot I's and take it at what it meant to the people who it was delivered to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, well, the people who were delivered to, it doesn't mean what they thought, that it actually means something different that became clear once the New Testament was given.
Mm. Okay.
So that when God, and that's why I'm always hammering on that theme too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying that this part of Jeremiah that talks about the Levites is actually talking about New Testament believers, but since there is no, that you know, the New Testament hasn't been given yet, it's not clear that that's what it's about. And then when the New Testament comes, that gives us license. We read the New Testament, and then our understanding of that allows us to reinterpret the Old Testament in a way which allows us to fulfill those things by what we see in the New Testament. So what I would say is the Old Testament makes certain predictions, and the New Testament has these other things, and they don't fit together, and therefore the Old Testament predictions are still unfulfilled. And the New Testament church is just something different completely from this Levitical line, right? And so, to me, when they want to bend the New Testament, you know, they want to bend the Old Testament, they want to kind of bend it and then plug it into the New Testament, that bending changes the meaning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what that means then is that God gave revelation that was misleading. It wasn't just incomplete, it was misleading.
But that almost sounds like replacement theology if you take it and
well, that's exactly
start cramming
what
it is.
And so most of these people would be in the line of replacement theology.
Okay.
As soon as you say the New Testament church is Levites, you're pretty much saying that we're the new Israel, including the priestly line, right? So there's this whole area where where people like myself are looking at these details and taking them at a fairly face value, and we would be charged of being over literal. And so that's where I back up, as does Paul Hindenburg and other people, and say, look, this isn't about how Tony Garland interprets the scripture, it's about the character of God.
Mm-hmm.
Is God allowed to say, you know, in this Jeremiah 33, you know, the line of David is never lack a man, the Levites will never lack a man.
Mm-hmm.
And then 400 years later, come out and say, well, I didn't really mean the line of David, I didn't really mean the line of Levi. Is that accurate for him to give a message for 400 years that very clearly means one thing, and then later say, well, that's not what it means. And by the way, all of you who were reading it for 400 years, I kind of left you with a mistaken notion. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Oops.
So tell me, what do they do when the Levites, or if they say the Levites are, you know, now the New Testament church, whatever, what do they do with the sacrifices that the Levites do?
Well, they would say that that's when we come and worship, we're giving sacrifices of praise. Right.
Well, not really literal.
Not literal.
It gets twisted to be
right.
Worshipers or whatever.
Right. Well, and I think
we
can find New Testament passages that make a pretty close analogy to, you know, what we do is a sweet aroma to God, our prayers and our worship. Right.
That's not as difficult a bend. Right.
And what's really happening in a lot of this is there is this valid principle of typology, which is that things that occur earlier in the Bible point to things that are similar later on. And so but it's not the same as identity. And so we would say things like, if we look at Ezekiel's temple, for example, the dwelling presence of God comes into this temple and takes up residence and never leaves. Well, that's very similar to the Holy Spirit comes into the believer, takes up residence and never leaves.
No.
And we are a temple. Okay, so there's typology.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily identity, right? It's a model that points to another reality that's similar. But it doesn't mean that this temple that's back here that's got all these cubits and all these blueprints is the New Testament believer. And so they tend to use typology in a way to posit fulfillment.
Okay. All
right. So that's why I kind of always am going back to this issue of, is God allowed to, I mean, God creates language. He creates humans with the ability to communicate, and he uses language to communicate with us, and he says over and over, his word will never be broken, not one jot or one tittle, Jesus says. So he just makes all these emphases about not just his word, but the written word, the scriptures. And then we can come in later and say, well, this is what it meant to the people who read it, but that's not what it really means.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not saying that the New Testament gives more information about this. They're actually saying it's different. Mm-hmm. It's not what is said in the Old Testament doesn't happen. There is this temple never happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is not a Levitical descendant because, you know, it's Sid, and Sid's not from the line of Levi. He's a New Testament believer. So that's where people like myself come back and say, well, oh ye of little faith, you know, when God says something, he's going to bring it about.
Mm-hmm.
And our job is to figure out, okay, not just to say, well, we doubt it can ever really literally be this way, and therefore we're going to bend it and change it.
Yeah, I kept thinking that verse, you let God be true and every man a liar.
Yeah.
You know, and when there's these other things.
Right. So
why would they need to make clear in Hebrews that Jesus is not in the Levitical priesthood too? I mean, that's New Testament.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right. And see, that's where I go too. I'm going, you know.
I know, I got these notes from you, which you did teach on. You said you didn't teach on it, but I have all these things scribbled in here about all that.
So the same, you know, so the same, you have to decide how are you going to read the Bible. Because back here in the Old Testament, in this book of Jeremiah, now we're not even in Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Ezekiel we have this Levitical line with Zadok that looks like it's in the future. And that looks like, well, that conflicts with Hebrews, a lot of people think. And then now I'm over in Jeremiah 33, a whole different prophet, whole different period of time too. They're like 200 years apart roughly. And he's over here talking about a Levitical line that's going to last as long as the Davidic line implies. And so right away we go, well, that's got to be Jesus. He's king and priest. Except the same book in the New Testament, Hebrews, says it's clear that our Lord didn't arise in the priestly line of Levi, which we knew anyway. But I'm just saying, the author of Hebrews, who's making the big case about Jesus being this once-for-all sacrifice, he's underscoring the fact that Jesus is not a Levite. So now you've got this Bible. One part says there's this Levitical promise. Hebrews says Jesus is not, in case you haven't noticed, Jesus is not a Levite.
They're and both, it matters.
They're both in the Bible. So now you have your choice, okay? The Holy Spirit is the Spirit of truth. All of Scripture is inspired. That means that all of it is true. So how do you take these two truths and work them out? And I'm saying the way you work them out is you don't change one to make it mean the other. When there's a conflict, you allow there to be a conflict, and you use the God-given thing, which is every bit as important as the laws of the universe and physics. It's called logic. We use logic, and God gave us logic. Logic, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. Logic's like kind of, because we're in a postmodern age, logic is on the ropes. You know, it's considered passé, a Western idea, and somehow not as important as all these other attributes. If you talk to people about like the weak nuclear force or the law of gravity or, you know, all these other fundamental forces, they're all real big on it. Oh yeah, that's how the universe works. But when you get to logic, there's this like, oh well, yeah, logic, yeah. But logic is every bit, I mean, in some ways it's superior to these other things because it's a concept. In some ways it's like a higher ideal. It's not actually a physical. It's not a physical reaction. You can't destroy logic. You know, it's just like the number two. The number two isn't something you can go destroy the number two. You can't. It's a concept.
Yeah.
And those concepts come from an intelligence, God. And the laws of logic come from God. And in the same kind of logic where we look at all these details of the Bible and we say that when Jesus shows up in the Gospels, he's the son of David. And look, here's a genealogy. We can prove Jesus is the son of David. Well, that's logic. So, well, we can prove that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. It says he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Look over here, he's born in Bethlehem. Well, that's logic. You're appealing to logic to prove that Jesus fulfills prophecy. In fact, without logic, you can't have prophecy. Right? So then when we get to these situations, it's like, well, logic doesn't matter. Because logic shows that a certain conclusion can't be the right conclusion. You can't have it both ways, right? So you have to, that's why when I'm saying when you look at the, look at what it says about this prince at the end of Ezekiel, what we're doing there is we're doing detective work using logic. Well, any detective uses logic, right? You know, if you've ever played Clue, remember the board game,
yep.
Clue?
Love that.
You know, is it in this room with this weapon with this person, right? And it's like story problems when you're in junior high, which we all hated, right? So, and we're looking at this end of Ezekiel like a story problem. We said, what does this say about the prince? Well, he looks like maybe it's David or in the line of David. Well, it looks like it could be Messiah. Well, over here, he's told not to do something. Well, that rules out Jesus, and that rules out David too if he's glorified.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a sin offering. Well, that doesn't work for those guys either. So what we're doing is we're building that little grid thing with the little check boxes, right? The truth mm-hmm. table sort of mm-hmm. thing, and we're acing out possibilities. We're saying it can't be this, it can't be that. Okay, so where do we go? And it leads us in a direction that leads us toward truth,
mm-hmm.
which is. It's, you know, and so like with Andy, if Andy thinks it's David, and he may, I haven't actually heard Andy teach on this section, but I would sit down ask, my first question I would ask Andy is, why does it say, oh prince, don't do this thing? Don't take away the inheritance from your son. Is David glorified or is he not? If he's glorified and he can sin, what are the implications?
Mm-hmm. So can we.
So can we. Mm-hmm. And so what does it mean for us to be glorified? Mm-hmm. Right? And I think you'd be going against, and I don't think Andy would go this way, but I think you'd be going against a lot of Christian understanding for over the centuries about what glorification means, because glorification is understood to be the point at which we become sinless. So that's where I would go with that, and I would say, gosh, the fact that he's told not to do certain things or associated with making offerings for himself, and I can't find the exact passage, it's in my notes, but I don't have the right address. Let me look at something here.
Wasn't in Isaiah, was it?
For the print?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That was too old. Isaiah 66:18-20. So I don't think that's what we were looking for.
Yeah, I think it was in.
As I keep reading it, I don't think it is.
I thought it was in Ezekiel.
Yeah, I think it's in Ezekiel too.
That's where we were reading.
It's like, oh yeah, I really want to find this, and I'm having trouble finding it. Let's see here.
We looked at Ezekiel 37.
But everything I keep finding is about generally, and princes in general, not a specific one.
Or the prince is doing it for the house of Israel.
Okay, there it is. Ezekiel 45:22.
Oh, we haven't got there yet.
Yeah. Well, that's not
what you said. Ezekiel 45:12, I think.
Yeah, that is a typo.
So it's a 22.
I jumped 10 verses when I hit
well,
a 1 instead of a 2.
No.
I searched. Oh. I've got one of those electrical Bibles you can search in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he
On that friends. Day the prince shall prepare for himself.
I remember you.
And for all the people of the land, a bull for a what? A sin offering. So can David prepare a sin offering for himself after he's resurrected?
Can he?
Oh, yeah, can he? Okay.
Well, I mean, would it mean anything? Does he need to?
That's what I say. Why would he?
Why would he? Why would he have an instruction? And for all the people,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's putting him in the same sinful category as the rest of the people there.
Well, it's kind of like that when Jesus was baptized and he really didn't need to be baptized. It's one of those that, it's different, but it's that same kind
right.
of example. So
okay.
Could God be using it as an example to other people?
That's a possibility. And I think that's a valid possibility, except
yeah.
there's another verse over here that says, don't do this bad thing.
It's
yeah.
a bad thing to do that.
Right, the one...
Yeah.
The one that says,
so it just canceled out
that
right?
Let me see where it is. Ezekiel 46:18. Moreover, the prince shall not take any of the people's inheritance by evicting them from their property.
Yeah.
So he's given the prince instructions about something he might do that he shouldn't do. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying the prince
mm-hmm.
is going to do this, but he's saying the prince shall not do this.
But that's not saying the prince will do it.
No.
He shall give
but
his
sons
inheritance
right.
out of his own, from his own property.
Right.
But is he really talking to the prince, or is he talking to the people about this is the prince
will
not
do.
He will not be doing this, so don't worry about
so
it.
So he's above board.
I don't know. I mean,
but if you read the context, so look what it says. The prince shall not take any of the people's inheritance by evicting them from their property. He shall provide an inheritance for his sons from his own property.
Mm-hmm.
So that none of his people will be scattered from his property.
Yeah.
It's kind of implying that he has the potential to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to skip back Jubilees, because they give that anything they have to take, they have to give back, because it all reverts back to the original family, doesn't it?
And you think it has?
Yeah, it has in the past. But I'm just saying there, it looks like it's saying that the prince could be tempted to give his son an inheritance from other people's property. Because that's kind of the, it's like, why would he say that to someone who is sinless? Why would he?
Because then you think of the, of you know, she's beat up on the temple and saying, coming to him and to, you know.
Right. So it's, you know, it's possible, I guess.
I mean, it's just,
you know, like Kevin says, it's possible to read it in a way where it's just saying, this is something he won't do. Prince, but it doesn't say the prince is not going to do it. It says the prince shall not. You know?
But it's regulations for the prince. Like, there's regulations for the priest, but there was lots of different priests. Mm-hmm. So if there's regulations for the prince, there's lots of princes. Of
right.
course, the one that would, well, except that we're talking, no, because then we're talking about during the millennial reign, though. Mm-hmm. We know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
And this is talking about
it's
a specific prince.
Got to be a prince that's alive during that time. It couldn't be David. Because David.
Well, he'll be alive during that time.
Well, yeah, but he will be alive.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not arguing that it is, but
right.
I think of some of the Psalms when David's praying to God. He's making that, like, don't take your Holy Spirit from me. It's
mm-hmm.
like, well, we know God's not going to sin, but he's implying, like, well, if there's just implication, you know, some
mm-hmm.
of the things that are said to God directly, it's like, I sometimes I go, whoa. Easy, David. But, you know, it's a little different. So,
mm-hmm.
I would...
Well, David then was a man on the earth who that
right,
was
but,
a possibility.
But my point was, he's saying things to God that God can either do or he won't do. But, Dave, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's hard to... I'm not really describing it that well, but... And I'm not arguing that it's David either, but...
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a very different time period, and why would you need to say this to somebody like David? You wouldn't need to say this to David, or
well,
I'm
not talking to David though. He's talking to the people.
He's talking to the people, but and so that's kind of the question: how much is directed directly to the prince, and how much is about the prince to the people? Right?
Yeah.
So, but the thing is here is like, I would. Setting aside the sin offering he makes for himself, which I think is pretty strong, if we just look at verse 18 in Ezekiel 46, I think there's this issue where why wouldn't it just say the prince shall provide an inheritance for his sons from his own property?
Right.
If it's just
yeah.
declaring what he's going to do. Instead
mm-hmm.
it's saying here's what you might think he's going to do, which isn't a good thing. But he's not going to do that. Here's what he's going to do. So why is he mentioning
the negative,
the potential
mm-hmm.
negative?
Because there's maybe some others that would, and this guy stands
yeah.
out as righteous.
Yeah, because
yeah.
it's written more like what you would see in Leviticus or something. It's like,
well,
it's like
do,
writing
the
law.
Because the kings will
yeah.
not do this.
Yeah.
He won't have a lot of horses. He gives these stipulations. It's almost in the same
yeah.
deal as that.
Right. So anyway, for you know, it's a tough one to know
yeah.
for sure. This is one of those areas again where you know we can't get all dogmatic about it. But in my mind, the combination of him making a sin offering for himself,
mm-hmm.
along with this instruction that seems to be kind of saying, don't do this underhanded thing that you might think of doing. Do it this way instead. In other words, don't take the people's land for your sons.
Mm-hmm.
You can give your sons land, but it got to come from your land. Well, that kind of, it doesn't directly say he's a sinner, but it kind of implies there's a potential that he could do this other thing that it mentions. And if
boy,
there's a potential...
You know, I read that, though, as simply making a statement. The prince will not do this. I don't see it as warning the prince not to. That's not how I read it.
Uh-huh.
That sentence.
The prince
well,
shall not.
But,
yeah,
you
but won't.
Thou
you won't.
Shalt not kill. That means don't do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
But if the prince is, you know, I guess my question would be, if the prince is a glorified individual who's sinless, why does he even need to say that?
Yeah, I don't have an answer for it.
Yeah, it's a toughie.
Yeah.
It's a toughie.
I mean, that's even that is the subjective. That's a little subjective because
right.
You it's can't argue, well, you can't always argue from that.
No, it's not a, it's
yeah.
like arguing from silence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
You can't say for certain, based on that alone,
right.
that he's a sinner. I think it definitely, to me anyway, implies that individual could do this other thing and
yeah.
either in the mind of the people he could do it, or he himself actually could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And God's either, he's reassuring the people that, oh, he's a good guy, he's not going to do that. Or he's actually saying, don't do this. And in either case, it's like the people think it's possible or they need to be told it's not going to happen, which implies that it could happen,
mm-hmm.
which to me implies he could be a sinner. Mm-hmm. Or at least the people think he could do this wrong thing. And so God
yes.
is telling them.
Yes.
But you can say that the least you could say is that the passage implies that other people are potentially worried he could
yeah.
do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So,
well, go ahead.
Oh, the only other thing I was going to say is, if I'm following this along, the original sin still exists here.
Mm-hmm.
So that means he does, if he's immortal, he is subject to that sin from Adam.
Right. So
Which is why it's the question. Is it David, really David? Or is it just somebody in his line who is mortal still?
Mm-hmm.
But here's a verse from 45. Well, I'm going to back up, but it's referring to the land thing, and it says 45:7. The prince shall have land on either side of the holy allotment of the property of the city, adjacent to the holy allotment of the property of the city, on the west side, toward the west side, toward the west, and on the east side, towards the east, and the length comparable to one of the portions from the west border to the east border. This shall be his land for possession in Israel. So my princes shall no longer oppress my peoples, but they shall give the rest of the land to the house of Israel according to their tribe. And so now it's referring to the plural, like the whole line of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Instead of a one guy like David.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I don't know.
So we know for sure that there are sinners in the picture because there's offerings and atonement.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, and to me that 45:22, you know, where it says that he offers, that the offering is for himself as well. Yeah, on that day the prince shall prepare for himself.
Yeah.
And for all the people.
Yeah, that's problematic for the
David. A bull for a sin offering.
But
I'm
which
like,
prince?
Wow.
Tell me that verse again.
45:22.
Okay.
And so, to me, unless there's, you know, and of course, there's always, you know, you always think something a certain way until you meet someone else who has a better grasp of things and they explain it to you and you go, oh yeah, I haven't looked at it that way. And maybe Andy has that kind of an insight, I don't know. But to me, I would go, wow, how could that be David?
It's been a while since I've listened to
it. No, I know, but I appreciate you sharing that, though, too, because...
That came across my mind when I saw David's back in. That's why I still believe that he said that, because that's what I caught from him, mm-hmm. and that's what stuck in my head. In fact, I think I mentioned it to you about that time.
Mm-hmm.
I said, David's coming back?
Well, he is definitely coming back.
But you know what I'm saying? But he was ruling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I, from the Jerusalem. But
okay, can I walk out on a ledge?
Sure.
This is a horrible analogy, but I'm going to make it anyway because
okay.
I think of the original creation, right? God rested on the seventh day.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need any rest. It doesn't say he needed rest, but he did as an example to us.
Uh-huh.
So, could this
just like this, Dad was saying.
He's preparing a sin offering as an example. That's a sin,
well,
I told
is.
You. So that they do this as he's doing it.
Well, that's what
Deb
said. That's why Jesus got baptized.
Right.
Like,
so
he didn't need to be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, exactly. So we're together on this.
Uh oh, there's two of them together.
No, that's not. It's a
yeah.
It's a bad analogy.
You know, to me, you're at a point. You know, you're kind of you're.
All those princes.
I think you're out of
the
I don't think
all,
the analogy is that problem.
You know,
in, but
oh, we're all oppressing. This is the one guy that is oppressing.
But when
that
it,
could be one of those that oppressed, but he's not.
If
he's standing up and goes,
oh, right.
Kind of my point.
If it says, on that day the prince shall prepare a bull for a sin offering and for all the people of the land, I'd be fine with that.
For himself.
But
yeah.
It says, shall prepare for himself.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for them, it's for himself and for them.
Right.
And it patterns, if we went back and looked at the high priest in the Old Testament, he has to do the same sort of thing.
Right.
He has to offer for himself
and
then for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And Hebrews makes a point of that too, that we have a high priest who didn't need to make an offering for himself,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to these guys
mm-hmm.
who do have to make it, because our high priest is sinless.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are...
Mary again in that verse 5 or whatever about, you know, all of the princes are oppressing the people, you know, in their land or whatever, oppressing, I don't know how it was worded. And then this guy's coming along and he's not going to be doing as all of his brothers or whoever or all those other princes are.
Right.
And that's what I take it as, you know, he's standing out from them. He's going to be different than them. He's not going to be the one that's oppressing, taking land from other people to give to his own son.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is.
Okay, here's another one. Okay, Jesus as a boy, he was a Jew. He participated in the, I'm sure he went to the temple, you know, where they gave sacrifices for the people. He didn't personally need it because he didn't sin.
Right.
But he did. He went along with it. I'm sure he, well, didn't, I don't know if it says that, but.
Mm-hmm.
So, he...
Right.
He's God. He didn't need that. He didn't need to participate.
Yeah, that's true.
He didn't participate.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need to participate in the offering.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not even as an example, he didn't. Did he?
Well, we don't know what he did.
It doesn't. Yeah, this is total flying by the.
But there's this other issue too with Jesus, which is where it's a little bit unique,
mm-hmm.
is that Jesus was born under the law. And fulfilled the law.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
Jesus walked
right.
under the law to demonstrate perfect obedience,
mm-hmm.
and in that perfection, he essentially freed us from the law.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We trust in him.
We kept everything.
So there's a sense in which it's mm-hmm. you know, this what
yeah.
we're talking about is the same as the temptation of Jesus, right? The temptation, taking him
yeah.
out in the wilderness
yeah.
to tempt him.
Right.
So there's this 2,000-year-old discussion.
Right. Did it? Was he really tempted?
Could he have sinned? Right.
No,
and
there's no place he actually prepared a sacrifice for himself, whereas one of the priests did that.
Well, yeah, we don't.
So if Jesus hasn't done that, this guy has to be different then. That
well,
if you're going to compare offering a sacrifice for yourself.
Mm.
That's
well,
what your point is, isn't it?
Yeah. That I'm saying that on its face it looks like the person is offering a sin offering for their own sin. For themselves.
What do you think?
Well, I've already said
that's
I think
yeah.
a few
think
times
is,
what I
right?
think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's Jesus or David. I think it's a sinner.
Yeah.
I think this priest is
we're
a sinner. A human
right.
non glorified descendant.
The descendant of David.
Right.
Right. Okay.
That's what I think.
I thought that's what I was hearing, but
right. But I think, you know, I think this is a good discussion because it does bring out the subtleties in careful
mm-hmm.
thinking, right? You know, so like I probably jumped the gun a little in what I said about, well, he could do this wrong thing. I think Kevin's made a pretty good case that, well, it doesn't necessarily mean that.
Mm-hmm.
It means that somebody thinks he might do the wrong thing because it's mentioned, and
yeah.
so God's communicating to whoever's reading this, that whoever this is, he's not going to do this bad thing.
Yes.
And so whoever he is, somebody's got a concept that we need to be told he won't do this bad thing. Because if you just out told us that this priest mm-hmm. is Jesus, you wouldn't need to tell us that.
And God constantly reminds us of the things that he is doing for us. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He's going, you know, like he doesn't need to do that, but he's continually saying, I will do this for you. I'm arguing from the opposite position.
Right. Right. So anyway, it's somewhat like the temptation mm-hmm. of Jesus. And there's, you know, if you read about the discussions of the temptation among different theologians going back, there's a couple different Latin phrases that talk about the subtleties of how to think about the temptation. But ultimately, I think most of us in the room would say it was not possible for him to sin, and that the temptation was the demonstration. It was several things. It was demonstrating who he was, and also putting him in the same essential position as Adam, where he does the right thing when Adam did the wrong thing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a tricky thing when you really start digging down into that whole, because you get at that whole area where you've got the God-man. You know, he grew mm-hmm. in stature and wisdom. He grew up as a baby in a family, as a little kid, and yet was sinless, and being God, you know, not able to sin.
A question I had, you got this human prince, meaning, you know, unglorified. What did he just come out of? If you saw the first one, they just come out of the tribulation,
mm-hmm.
and it was all... The temple and everything was pretty well whacked out. There was, well, they weren't doing it right, more than likely.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be why that person was warned, just because they were coming out of that?
It's possible.
I'm just throwing it out there.
That same thing. I was thinking, well, here's the context of the tribulation. You know, they've seen the Antichrist come in and, you know, offer this offering, and, you know, he looked good, but wasn't. This is like, oh, now they're going to be gun shy, and now this time they're going to go, oh, okay, it's, you know, it's like making extra sure this isn't that, you know, another repeat.
I'm just thinking out loud.
Anyway, that crossed my mind too.
Yeah. So, so that gets at this other kind of area, which is the temple in Revelation 11, which I would say is the tribulation temple. Is different than this temple, but it's built by, or I think it's built by Orthodox Jews who are attempting to go back, you know, are attempting to go back to temple offerings and sacrifices. And so the question is, if they're going to go back to temple offerings and sacrifices, what version of law are they going to be, what kind of temple, what kind of version of law are they going to go to? Are they going to look at this Ezekiel pattern for some of it, or are they going to go straight back to Moses? You know, in other words, as Herod's temple, the second temple mm-hmm. was destroyed, are they going to try and recreate the second temple period and ideas and rules that pertain to essentially the same as what was in Solomon's, or are they going to look to this book of Ezekiel, which they really struggled with because it's different? I don't really know. We don't really know what's involved there. And so it's really difficult for us to know. I mean, when you read in Revelation 11, you've got like four sentences on it, and that's it. And you're left to, you know, fill in the pieces from a lot of other little snippets.
Mm-hmm.
But you really don't know what's in their mind.
But you think how ingrained the law is with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be hard for them to break loose from the old ways in some, you know, in a sense. And all of a sudden just strip your gears and start into something new. And I don't know. I was just thinking that way. I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm.
So Tony, have you done any comparison between the different temples and their worship and their sacrifices to know which one this lines up with the most?
Well, this one's like completely different than Solomon in many different ways. And so there was, historically, when the Jews were discussing which books they considered to be inspired, essentially, or of God, this book was controversial because it differs from Moses. So there's a sense in which, this is maybe
God's
sounds a little bit weird.
God's testing them to leap of faith, kind of.
No, I'm just saying there's a sense in which the Jews were inconsistent in that, the reason that a lot of Jews rejected Jesus, or supposedly today reject Jesus, is in their mind he teaches a different Torah than Moses. Okay, that's how they say it. Jesus' Torah differs from the Torah of Moses, and therefore he can't be the Messiah. And by that they mean there are things that Jesus said that change or differ from things Moses said, and therefore they reject him.
And so that's what you're thinking, they would take it that same way, this is too much of a change.
Well, some do, but I'm saying the fact that I can go and get the Jewish Publication Society, Jewish Study Bible, or the Tanakh, or whatever, and I can open it, it has Ezekiel in it. Okay, so they consider, so what I'm saying is there's some duplicity here, because here is a law, the Torah of Ezekiel is different than the Torah of Moses. Because if you sit down and look at the offerings and all the things you're supposed to do, there's a bunch of differences. And so Ezekiel is describing a temple and a priestly offering system that is not like Moses. But they accept Ezekiel as canonical. But they reject Jesus as non-canonical.
Right.
Right? If you want to look at it that way. So I'm just saying that they make it out like the reason we reject Jesus is because he says things that we don't think line up with Moses.
And, yet,
and by the way, we accept Ezekiel, and he says things that don't line up with Moses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, I get you.
And so that's where it gets difficult to... so like even the guys that wrote that book that I brought here a while back the guys made the models and stuff of this temple. He was talking about how... when he had talked to some of the leading rabbis that were involved with the Temple Institute and stuff, they said that, you know, there's nobody around here that would do any of this Ezekiel stuff because it differs from Moses, and they won't touch it. They won't try to put this in place because it's in their mind they're not sure what to do with it. They don't like it. In other words, they're kind of like the Christians that look at Hebrews and look at this and say, well, this can't be, right? It'd be like going to find a Christian that believes that Hebrews says that it's impossible forever to be any other kind of sacrifice ever, period, QED, and then tell them, okay, take Ezekiel, the end of Ezekiel, literally. They won't do it because it's just like, well, it can't be. And so there's Jews today, too, that we're thinking, oh, they're ready to build a millennial temple. And so, well, they're ready to build a temple, but... not necessarily this one, because it's a hot potato. What is this thing, right? So, you know, the popular choices for the prince, it's David, it's the Messiah. Those are the two most you'll hear. And then third down on the list is a descendant of David. If it didn't say that he shall prepare an offering for himself, I would vote for David, it being David, King David himself. But I can't put that together. Because, I mean, it essentially says there's validity in offering. To me, it's saying there's a need I don't, you know, I just think that that passage is pretty clear. It'd be like saying, Jesus shall prepare for himself and for all the people of the land a bull for a sin offering.
So
could you really find a sentence like that in the Bible? I mean, I've got to scream and run away. No.
I don't see it as a particular guy. Like, I see it as the prince, generally speaking, because it's going to be a bunch of them over this period of time.
Right, but at a given minute, there is this prince in the line of David, and he and his descendants. I'm seeing
it has to start somewhere.
Yeah, it has to start somewhere, and it's 1,000 years, so I think there's a series of people that are in this position. It's not one person who lives 1,000 years. Right? So if he's human, he's going to die. And one of his sons in the line would be... Sense. And so, yeah, the prince is, in my mind, he's in the line of David, a descendant, and whoever the one is alive at that time, it'd be like the high priest. I think you're reading it the same way. On that day, the high priest shall prepare for himself. Well, who is the high priest at the time?
Why isn't he called a king then?
Well, because he's not a king. He's a chief officer. A ruler, chief, or leader.
But David's line is king.
I know. He is the king, yeah. King David.
But in the millennial kingdom,
isn't
Jesus considered? No?
Yeah, Jesus is going to reign on the throne.
So there can't be two kings.
Right.
Yeah. If Jesus is king, there can't be another one.
Yeah. So I think these guys are called prince in a similar way to the Davidic line between Zerubbabel and Jesus. Right.
But just underneath, next step, they would be king.
They had the qualifications to be king. They were in the line of David. But they weren't actually installed to rule as kings. So they're never called kings, they're called governors or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lesser rank. It's rank, but it's lesser.
It'd be sort of like your leadership in England. Yeah, Prince Charles and his next line, it would be king if it went that way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's how I would say that, is the prince is trying to underscore that this person is not the top in the government, right? And the princes and the prince, they're leaders. Because you know, like we've looked at before, when you get into Matthew's genealogy, there, you know, it's king this, king that, king the other, until they're hauled off to Babylon, and then it's names but no kings. Well, they're all qualified to be kings, you know, and so when they come back from Babylon, why didn't these guys like Zerubbabel, why weren't they made king? Why weren't they proclaimed king and made king? And my answer to that is that it's the times of the Gentiles, and it's God's purpose that during the times of the Gentiles there will not be a man ruling on the throne of David. In fact, I think that's what essentially defines the times of the Gentiles, is there is no ruler on the throne of David during that period of time.
Yeah.
And so here you've got the situation where you have Jesus on the throne of David, and you also have this continuing human line in the line of David, and they're in a lesser role. So that would maybe explain why it uses prince. But it's all very, you know, this is one of those passages, these passages in the end of Ezekiel are probably about as much hair pulling as you'll run into. And I mean, there's other parts of the Bible that are also really, you know, like the Trinity or creation, or you know, there's just lots in the Bible that's really mind bending, but this is one of those areas. And so it's hard to me it's kind of like you look for the big things to guide you, and then there's a host of little things that you can't really be sure about. You know, like we look at the fact that this the number of cubits that are the number of times the word cubit shows up in this,
mm-hmm.
and the things that are said about it. You know, you have to believe. I think you have to believe that Ezekiel's trying to describe a building,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just a spiritual lesson about something else. It's mm-hmm. a building. And so I think when you come into this, it's like when people say fly on instruments, right? If you're going to fly on instruments in an airplane in the fog, you have to trust those instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute you start wavering in your trust for the instrument, you're in big trouble,
mm-hmm.
because then you're going to start... the GPS is wrong or whatever. And so... To me, this passage is kind of like that. It's like you have to establish and test your instruments. What's your instrument? Okay, what's your GPS? What's your compass? What's your altimeter? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you look at those things and you become very convinced that those instruments are guiding properly.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, those instruments are literal interpretation. God can't change this to mean something different.
Mm-hmm.
It's never occurred. It's different than the mosaic thing, but it's every bit as detailed and looks a lot like Deuteronomy and Leviticus, where this sort of stuff is told about a different temple. So when you lay those principles down, those are the things that have to be your kind of your guidance, your instruments, because as you go further along and you read this stuff, you want to jump ship. You want to go, this can't be, this is too strange, right? There can't be these guys who are princes in the line of David and they're not kings. There can't be a human offspring in the line of David when there's also Jesus. There can't be humans that are unglorified at the same time as people who are glorified. There can't be a huge temple on this huge period of land in Jerusalem. There can't be. And so there's enough can't be's in this passage that unless you've got your seatbelt on and you're really keeping your eye on the instruments, you just are not going to make the flight. You're going to skip out and go somewhere else. You're going to go, this must be spiritual, or this book shouldn't be in the canon.
Okay, I got one more for you.
Okay.
All right. So I'm thinking back to Acts when Paul...
He's really stuck on
it. No, I'm not stuck on it. We're exploring the parameters here.
Okay.
Paul participated, you know, I'm just reading it in 21. He was born again. He did not need to make offerings for his sins because he knew Christ.
Not for his sins, no.
Right, but he still participated in the temple.
Well, he took a vow, too, cut all his hair.
Right, and so he's doing that for several reasons.
Right.
And none of them are to atone for himself.
Not for his sin, no.
Right.
Right.
So, it's just a...
But it doesn't say that he offered a sin offering for himself.
It does not say that.
Right?
It
doesn't. So I have to wonder if Peter said to him, you know, people are saying that you don't follow the laws of Moses and you teach against the laws of Moses, so I want you to go in and make a sin offering for yourself. Would Paul have done that?
No.
I don't think he wouldn't.
He wouldn't.
He wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Because it's absolutely contradictory. Right?
But he's participating in these things, from my understanding, out of love for his brothers. Right?
Right, and also because he's not teaching against Moses.
Right.
So, I mean, he's already taken a Nazarite vow or whatever during a period of time, and he's going back to Jerusalem to cut his hair and all that. And that's not a sin offering. It's a vow of dedication and a period of focus on God. And he's still, I think he thinks that's a valid thing he's doing.
Yeah.
And nobody told him to do it. So there's this whole area where you can look at what Paul's doing there in a couple of different ways. One way of looking at it is that he doesn't really think there's any validity in any of the stuff there, but he's doing it just to keep the peace. And I don't think that's where he's coming from. That doesn't sound like Paul.
Yeah.
The other one is that people have been taught that he's anti-Moses because he's teaching that the law can't provide salvation. And so because he's having to teach that the cross, the scandal of the cross, he's in their mind, he's demeaning the law. And so in order to demonstrate that that's not his attitude toward the law, he's going through this. And I think that's closer to where he probably is. He still thinks that what's going on there is valid. It's not violating Hebrews per se, right? So these things are all tricky.
That's why I don't think Jesus would have offered offerings. Mm-hmm. I don't think he would have done it. Because he didn't need to.
No. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as a child, or you know, as a young man, I don't know enough about, you know, how that all applies to when they get older and all that, but I could see him going through that ceremony, because it just the same as baptism. He doesn't need to be baptized, but it's the thing to do. And in this particular case, I think it's very important that Jesus fulfills all the law. And when it says fulfills, I don't think it just means that his sacrifice brings to an end the need for the law. I think what it's saying there also is that he actually kept the law. He never broke the law.
Yeah.
And so if you could find a place where Jesus legitimately broke the, you know, where he really broke the law, then he's not sinless. Because how do you define sin?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's more than the law. It's in your heart and in your mind too, but it's at least the law.
Yeah.
So if Jesus, you know, like if somebody told me Jesus is driving down the street and I ran out there and I looked and he's going 51 miles an hour in the 50 zone, I'm like, that's not Jesus. I mean, if to make an analogy today.
Yeah, you have it straight on.
You know, because now he's going 51, he has to atone for the 1 mile he's gone over for himself. He's not the perfect lamb. He's got to carry his own sin, right? So, I mean, that's kind of a ridiculous example, and I'm not even sure it's valid, but...
Well, I agree. If the law said that all these people have to do this, he has to do it. I mean, and part of that was going to the temple and offering, you know.
And it wasn't efficacious in that it was needed
for him, but to him to be
right
to keep the law perfectly to save us from our sins, he did what the law said he had to do, whether he needed to or not.
Right. So I think, I mean, I just don't read it that way, but I mean, in Ezekiel 45:22, you could somehow say that the prince is going through the motions. He's sinless, but he's offering a sin offering for himself. But boy,
you're not selling that, Tony. He's been going through the motions. He's setting an example for his brothers that he loves. That this is what you need to. This is what you should be doing.
Yeah, but that's for the others, not for himself. So
I think baptism is different than offering an offering.
Well, it is.
I
but you still.
Oh, it is.
Who's he offering it to? He's the one you would offer it to.
Yeah.
I've got one more thing
to the Father.
There.
I was just reading that in Matthew, when Jesus was tempted, he was taken. He was taken by the devil into the wilderness to be tested, and then he says later, "Do not tempt the God." What does tempt mean? Right? Tempt means it has an effect. Otherwise, you're not tempted. Right? So I'm not saying Jesus could sin, but I think that's one of those things you can't explain, because I think he was tempted.
How did he experience it?
The author of the book is using the wrong words then.
So this is why this discussion has gone on for 2,000 years, and that's why there's these Latin phrases. There are different phrases, and I can't pull them right up off the top of my head, but it's basically, is he not able to sin, or is he able not to sin? And it sounds like the same thing, but there's this whole...
It's a valid...
There's
the valid
this whole,
temptation, just like the valid offer of the Messiah. You know?
Right. I would say the latter.
Right, so...
Why did he go through what he went through in the Garden of Gethsemane? He had that, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that... I'm just saying that it was a valid testing. So this is why this discussion goes on. Because the one side says, well, essentially says, you're not, you haven't said this, but they essentially say, if it's true temptation, then he could have fallen.
No, I'm not saying that.
No, you're not saying that. But that's what one side says. And the other side says, no, he's God, he can't fall.
Yeah.
Right? And then they say, well, then he wasn't really tempted. And to me, that's like putting human logic, it's like the Trinity.
Yeah.
You're putting human logic on something and saying, it's got to be this way or this way. Well,
right.
That's how it appears to your feeble human mind.
Right, exactly.
But the reality is that he was tempted and familiar with the pains and all this stuff. But he also, the reason he was taken out there wasn't just, how do I want to put it, so he would experience temptation. It was to show that he, as the last Adam, was going to be, would succeed and wasn't going to fall, and that he was not, it was not possible for him to fall.
Yeah, given the same situation.
Right.
He will respond differently.
Right. So, but again, I mean, when you, I mean, that sounds real nice to say that, but really, if you try to unwrap
you can.
There's a whole lifetime worth of puzzles
and
in
that.
And
we love those. I don't need to have put that in the one little box.
No. Right. So
some people do, though.
Right.
Yeah.
So you know, whether you want to put this section into a similar sort of thing and say that it's a sinless person that's going through doing these things, you know, it's hard to know when you read verse 22 when God is saying through Ezekiel or that the prince is offering for himself. You know, what does for himself mean? That's the tricky part.
Yeah.
If it means what it seems to mean, the most simple meaning, then he is a sinner. And then beyond that, you can get more sophisticated, I guess, and